thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak here. I'm a PhD student of Matthias Staudacher at the MPI in Potsdam. We'll talk about some work which I did together with Lisa Freiholt at Uppsala University, which is entitled Virtual Scaling Function in SCFT. Okay. Before I come to the point, what I really mean with this title, which I put in the very end, I will try to go through a little bit and say what I want to say about this function, and I will make use of several words like fluon scalings and rules and loops, and try to squeeze integrability into this and justify some steps of integrability by string theory considerations. And then I will try to review something which I need for this main part. I will review the cast numbers I mentioned, which is somehow and gives leading similarities of the Wilson loops and Euler scalings, can be computed from integrability. I will review how to get this integral equation, which determines this cast numbers I mentioned, and so to say the leading similarity of those two objects. And I will also try to repeat how you can compute it from, not only a weak coupling, which you do in Young-Wolf theory, but also a strong coupling, how you get it really from the whole way from n equals 4 to string theory, and that this thing really matches in the end. And I will use all this again for this new thing, which I entitled the virtual scaling function. I want to tell you at first what do I mean with those words. And there's some dirty trick in between, which I call you have to buy a pig in the poke. I will hopefully convince you that it's justified. And I will justify the string theory in the end. I will match numbers, and this is why I have to perform some analytic continuation from weak to strong coupling. Okay, what is the major goal? The major goal is to solve angles for super angles. And there are two ways to tackle this problem. One is to compute the complete spectrum of the rotation generator. So we have many talks on this now by using means. This can be done by integrability, by the spin chain, diagonalizing the spin chain, Hamiltonian. Or you could also do it differently by scattering, by computing all scattering amplitudes of all on-shell states. It's a bit strange because this is a conformal theory, so scaling doesn't really make sense because there's no asymptotic region. But in practice, this can be overcome by regularizing the theory in the infrared, and you can compute something. So I think an S matrix is well defined somehow.
And are you saying these two are equivalent, or are they?
I think that it should be this. So what I want to say, knowing all anomalous dimensions should maybe be the same as knowing all scattering amplitudes of all on-shell particles.
Why? Are they both from one to the other?
This I don't know, but I will try to get it to show it a little bit. That you can use, for example, the thing is, let me go to the next point. I was stealing some statement of Lance Dixon, some footnote in the appendix maybe, but that you can use maybe anomalous dimension to also compute all scattering amplitudes. So, you just, but I will try to say something on there.
Usually in a CFT you need both well, the spectrum, the anomalous dimension, and the structure constants, mm-hmm. right, in order to define the theory. So are you implying that integrability that somehow relates the two?
I would like to state this, but this is a very strong statement. So I will. So this is a statement that has to do with integrability. Gluon scattering is solved to one quarter. That means you can write all scattering amplitudes of gluons into four unknown functions. And knowing one function, okay, you can say I solved it to one quarter. And I want to convince you of that we can go on. So this is what I call vertical scaling function. We can solve it to 3/8. It's not a big advance, but okay. This is what I want to say. And if you feel done with this, you should maybe do it all again at strong coupling and compare with string theory and also try to say something like this. Okay, so I mentioned gluon amplitude, so let me just give one slide on what I'm talking about. If I And so there's this conjecture by Bernd, Dixon, and Smirnov. They propose the form of an N-gluon planar MHV scattering amplitude to take the following form. And you have a regulator, and they all usually choose dimensional regularization. So you have a divergent part, of course, which takes the form of two functions, 1 over epsilon squared poles, 1 over epsilon poles. And you have a finite piece for this amplitude, which is another function f of lambda, which is somehow related to the same function that also determines 1 over epsilon poles. And you have some function that doesn't depend on the coupling constant, just on the kinematics of the process. And you have two other functions which I don't want to mess with. But okay, just what I want to go for are these two functions that determine the divergent part of the amplitudes. So I think this is usually called in the literature the first function is related to the cusp anomalous dimension, f of lambda, and the later entitled the collinear anomalous dimension, g of lambda. Okay, and I also said in the first thing something. Lately, there were many papers on the duality and weak and strong coupling for gluon amplitudes and Wilson loops. I mean, expectation values of certain Wilson loops on light-like segments. I mean, some of the portion of the gluon emitter. And the expectation value takes somehow this form, and has also, of course, a divergent piece which arises from divergences, but ultraviolet divergences at the cusp of the Wilson loop. And it has also a finite piece, which just depends on the kinematics and two other functions which I also don't want to mess with. So what is this duality between Wilson loops and gluon amplitudes, which I think was first studied in the strong coupling regime by Alder and Malvasena. Later on continued to also state that this is the same at weak coupling. So one that is identical, which has been observed alternatively, is that the finite parts, I think the thing which come all the way behind the divergent pieces, they agree. I think this has been the first initiated in this paper, and later on also with Kochemski et al. By showing these perturbative calculations and matching the finite parts. But there's more that agrees. It's not only the finite part, also the leading pole, one over epsilon poles agree. And they are both related to something that has a meaning in integrability. And this is what I want to talk about in the first. So they are related to some anomalous dimension of twist two operators. But there's not only things that match between both pictures, there's also something that doesn't match. And this is the one over epsilon poles. So this collinear anomalous dimension of the Wilson loop and of the gluon amplitudes, they don't agree. And the difference between both is a virtual scaling function. Okay, want to convince you. I think Ben 6 is trying to convince people, I'm just trying to repeat it. Okay. For completeness, let me state that I was talking about a general number of lags of the gluon amplitudes, but it has been shown that this BDS conjecture is not correct. If you have more than six lags, and it has shown in various papers, the first one I think was Alder and Malvasena. They used some strong coupling argument and tried to first they assume that the Wilson loop and the gluon amplitude is the same, and they get the expectation value of the Wilson loop by approximating, by finding minimal surfaces then of these light-like segments. But they could just perform this calculation for a very large number of legs, where the number of legs goes to infinity. So they are not really sensible to where is the point where it goes wrong. But there still is another point. Their assumption is that gluon amplitudes and Wilson loops is the same. So it doesn't really, so the calculation gives two possibilities. Either the BDS conjecture is wrong, or Wilson loop's expectation values do not agree with the amplitudes of the gluon amplitudes. So this was, I think I tried to put it in chronological order, but I'm not quite sure if it is. Okay, then there was another paper concerning this issue about the difference of these two quantities by Kochemski, about these people. They were making use of conformal water identities that determines that can be used to determine the finite part, this little omega, which I had in the previous slide for the Wilson loop. And for more than six legs, conformal water identities just restrict the functional form of an arbitrary function of kinematical invariance. So if you assume that, but the gluon amplitudes are invariant under these high entities, so that means that you are somehow either missing a function or the BDS conjecture is wrong, or Wilson looks again to not agree with gluon amplitudes. So I think one thing that is purely put onto the Wilson to really show that there is something wrong just for the gluon amplitudes is by Lipatov and these people, by studying the analytic properties of the amplitudes in the high energy limit, and not really saying anything, except think either there is some cut or there is some missing, I don't know, but something is wrong with it. And this is especially for more than 6 lags. And finally, all those people came together and computed really the 2-loop 6 gluon MHD amplitude to show that there is something that is wrong. The BDS complex is not wrong. There is an additional function which is not captured. This is very unfortunate for what I said, because if you have another function, that means that you have now 5 unknowns, and the 3/8 goes over to 3/10. So that's why I will stick to 5 and 4 legs, because this looks a little better.
These are functions, in some cases, of the coupling, right? Or are they all functions of the coupling? Or
I think, they're functions of the coupling.
And is there still a belief that there's a finite, is there a well-founded belief that there are some finite number of functions of the coupling that would govern all the amplitudes of all kinematics?
I think so. I would say so for 5 and for 4 and 5 legs, that could well be. I think at least one should get the divergent piece somehow. And then there's this other function was in the slide, which is just multiplied by the number of legs. I think this arises in some collinear limit from consistency from the other two. So I don't know how to study the other functions. So to go step by step, I think it should be possible, I hope. That's what Dan Stevenson told me. Okay, well, I said that the leading poles, 1 over epsilon poles, are related to the cusp anomalous dimension, and which is in turn equal to the anomalous dimension of 2 operators.
1 over epsilon or 1 over epsilon squared?
1 over epsilon squared.
Sorry,
there's
a question about the previous one.
Yeah?
How then are the center proof that the Wilson lines in those amplitudes for MHP amplitudes weak with strong coupling?
They proved?
I thought they proved that strong coupling, that the Wilson line and the annual amplitude is weak.
They did. I mean, using the ADS CFT correspondence.
So they proved that the BDS conjecture was wrong. You said there was a choice.
I think there's a choice.
No, BDS was wrong.
It's wrong.
If the ADS CFT correspondence is correct.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
They used the ADS CFT correspondence.
Okay. So there's no choice.
Well, unless you want to throw away ADS CFT.
Yeah, I think there's no choice. Okay, twist two operators. So this is something we want to compute from integrability. And let me sketch this out how this could be done. Okay, first twist two operators, they can be represented by some state in n equals 4, by gauge invariant state, where you put, in general, twist operators, where you put this backbone field Z, which we heard about yesterday, and you're just putting a special kind of field that is a covariant light cone derivative into that field, into this long vacuum states of Z, and then I will use the word that's spin M, called spin M, which should maybe S, but it's a little bit confusing, but I say something later on this. And so this, an operator of spin M and twist L is given by the following formula, like L backgrounds fields Z, and the total number of all derivatives is giving the spin of the operator. So this is, you can compute then the anomalous dimension of such an object, and this is a non-compact spin chain, because at every point of the spin chain you put as many derivatives as you want. And why I call the spin M is in the spin chain language, you would consider these covariant derivatives to be Magnons. That's why we say the Magnon number is M. Okay, and you can use the beta unders to diagonalize the spin chain Hamiltonian and to compute the anomalous dimension of these objects. And also at high loops, we heard about it yesterday, because the S matrix that determines the factorized scattering of the spin chain particles is determined by the algebra and up to a phase, which can be constrained by a crossing light equation. And so, but this admits more solutions. but one of those solutions gets singled out, and I mean, how you get how it gets singled out, because it can reproduce one of the epsilon poles of the gluon magnitude. So this is our construction. There's a all the other talks we had about integrability is about the thing which we cannot address to, but the beta under so far, this is the wrapping effect. Okay, so the Hamiltonian is a long-range Hamiltonian of the spin chain. It was more orders and the coupling constant, the interaction of participating particles of the spin chain increases, and when it exceeds the length of the spin chain, you have like the particles are going to interact with themselves again. This is called wrapping effects. And for this special kind of operators in this representation in the FL2 sector, this happens to be at G to the 2L plus 4. So everything we can compute from the beta unders, we can go onto G to 2L plus 4. I mean, this will be the first thing that is wrong, which we can rely on. Okay. But what I want to say is we want to compute the anomalous dimension of twist 2 operators, that is L equals 2. That doesn't take us very far on the coupling, but we wanted to do that to all orders. So you need something to do that, because at the beginning you would say this is not possible. So there's a very nice feature of these anomalous dimension of these twist operators, and that is for a large spin, for spin to infinity, the anomalous dimension grow logarithmically with the spin. So that we have the leading part that multiplies this logarithmic divergency is given by some universal function f of g, and I put here a little l on this gamma, and it doesn't appear here, where I want to say that this function is universal. It is the same for all twists. So we are lucky, because we can just pretend that l is infinity, but put it to 2, and the result in the end will be the same, if we rely on this.
You should add it. This is another conjecture.
Yeah.
This was our original conjecture, and it's not proven so far. So one thing Volodya could try to do is to prove that the universal scaling function equals the twist 2 scaling function. Yes, that would be good.
What I just said implies that for every twist, the scaling function, now I gave it a little index F3F, everything is the same up to infinity. And this we can determine by the beta under. So f of g is somehow an all group result which you can pull out of. Okay, this was done by Matthias, Niklas, and Burkhardt. I don't want to really go into this, but this is a beta under which describes the spin chain which corresponds to this operator. So I have two Z fields which go in here, these two, and I have M magnums. So, and what you can do from this beta, this is this dressing phase, which I also don't want to comment on. So you can somehow solve these equations in the large M limit, because then you can extract this function f of g, which multiplies the log. And this was done. You take n to infinity and you find in terms of integral equations, and the end, your function f of g will be given by some 16 g squared of this quantity sigma hat, which is related to the density of the beta roots, and it's a very nice integral equation. So it's a linear integral equation of Poisson type, so it's a potential term. It looks also very simple, but okay, all the other things that are more complicated are hidden in this integral kernel, which is decomposed, in sums over Bessel functions. So what I want to stress by giving this formula is that somehow there's some parity inbuilt. You have some parity, parity with respect to slash, parity even function K0, the odd Bessel functions are parity odd on the T to minus T. Okay, got this factor of T to minus. So K is a parity even function, K1 is a parity odd function, and this dressing phase goes into this function Kd. So this is the thing that goes into this integral. But what is very nice about it is, this is a Fredholm integral equation, so you can just expand it at weak coupling and solve it iteratively. You can put this on a computer and this is very fast. So it just takes a few seconds to work it out for to for loop order. And what is really nice about it is it agrees really with very, very complicated computation of the four gluon scattering up to three loops. I mean, this gluon scattering for four LEDs was computed to three loops by Bernd, Dixon, and Smirnoff, and they also get a numerical result for the four-loop part, which was later on improved by these people. This is the error bars where it shrinks to something zero point, a finite set of zeros two. So it is a very good agreement. It's a thing that comes from the beta unders. And also you can Thalea approximate the first three orders or four orders and go to the fifth loop, and it's also a very good agreement. So that's really nice. So, but this is a recoupling result. And in view of ADS CFT, we also want to get something on the strong coupling. What is nice about this series is that it has a finite radius of convergences. But the problem about it, if you play, I think you can also see it from the integral equation when you play with numerics, that it does not very good behavior at strong coupling. It's an asymptotic series. And this makes to take the solution of the integral equation at strong coupling really tough. And it took a really long time to work it out. There are many people involved. First, it started with very many numerical approaches by all these people who were trying to get a numerical prediction for the first few strong coupling expansion coefficients, because they are known by in string theory. And I think the breakthrough then was by Basso, Kochensky, Kotansky, and Kostov and Saban and Volley, which really developed a very nice analytic approach to obtain these solutions, to really get this asymptotic series. Unfortunately, I will concentrate on the Basso, Kochensky, Kotansky method, so I'm sorry for this. But, so I will try to review a little bit the steps, how it works, how do you get the strong coupling results. Although I think I can admit that this is somehow based on a numerical input. You need something. You need to know something from numerics. And I think your result doesn't need any numerics. You can just work it out. Yeah. So maybe then yours is. I take Basso for chance. I'm sorry. Okay. The trick is, what is the essential point to really to.
I have one question. Is it anywhere formulated what the boundary conditions for the integral equations really are?
Maybe this probably inherited from the beta equations directly, if you want something.
Yeah, it's certainly inherited, but I'm not sure if it's written. I mean, I think it's probably the Basso-Kochensky-Kotansky result is based on some boundary condition or the right interpretation of it.
But yeah, how did, their result is always based on choosing some right analyticity properties which are in favor of the numerical studies. So this is the only thing I can say. Maybe your result.
You can translate this in saying that around the singularities of the spectral parameters, you get a well-defined density stays well defined, but I think there are no boundary condition to be imposed. I mean, we formulated this in terms of a resolvent for the density, and the resolvent should have the right properties, like.
Yeah.
If you want, you have to have a integrable, normalizable density.
So that's boundary condition?
That's the boundary condition you have to. But they implicitly.
So far, this is only implicit in all the works. So is it written anywhere explicitly?
Explicitly, no, but it's implicit in their work and in our work.
How do you take the strong coupling limit? And I put this function for before the kernel, that it can be decomposed into parity even or not parts. And what is the potential trick to work it out, at least if you follow this work, is that you split this density function, which is the density of beta roots, into parity even and odd parts. But these little gamma plus minus, I didn't write it, are some infinite series of our Bessel functions with coefficients, of course. And if you make this ANDAS for, I mean, you split first identity, then you make an infinite series of a Bessel function ANDAS for these little functions gamma, you can transform the integral equation on the previous slide to a set of infinite set of coupled integral equations. So infinite because it depends on some parameter n. So this is totally equivalent to the original integral equation, but it's also is written like this to go to strong coupling because you can already see that something is going wrong here. If you take g to infinity, this is not very well behaved, and you will see that somehow there is a problem to really take the strong coupling limit because there are non-perturbative effects. But I will comment on this maybe in the end, which are not captured by the analytic structures I will present to you. So what can be done? If you look at this integral equation, if I want to get rid of this coupling constant behavior of the kernel, I can perform a special change of variable which allows me to put everything that depends on the coupling constant into some new functions, capital gamma plus minus. I'm hopefully not to be confused with a gamma function, which will also pop up. Okay, so this is a transformation, it's not really important, but what it allows you is to decouple the integral kernel somehow from this G dependence and to put everything into new unknown functions. Okay. And to keep track of what is still our anomalous dimension, which we want to compute at strong coupling, it is then given by a special function, as you see again at 0.0, but there are gamma plus functions, and I wrote down, so this is a settled point. What is the analytic structure of these gamma objects? Because you have to put something. What is, so you again take an infinite series of Bessel functions, and gamma plus is a parity. Even it is composed of even Bessel functions and with some coefficients, and gamma minus is odd Bessel functions. So this is a little bit not very good. The slash here is different. This mutation and very good chosen. Okay, and these coefficients that appear here, they have the following dependence. There's the leading order coefficient. This was worked out numerically a long time, by other people. That was the major input of this work. And it, if you put here p to 0, it's given by this form. And you got some g dependence here. Of course, if you look at this, f of g is now given by something g times the function. And this function goes in here, it has coefficients, and all the dependence of the coupling constant is, just pushes every step, I push it somewhere else. First out of the integral equation, then in this function g, then I put it into the coefficients, and now I introduce new coefficients, these cp, and they take all the thing I don't like.
Okay. So is this a large g expansion then?
It is already a large g expansion, because I rescaled at one point t over and the variables in g. So the thing is not suited anymore to say something about recoupling. Okay, so these are the functions that enter into the coefficient, but it's not very short what they look like. But to get their structure, this is also already somehow a numerical input a little bit that we work with all these people from Princeton. Okay, so if I just use these definitions, I can simply write the scaling function and strong coupling in these new unknowns. So you see, I have the leading order that is posed already out for G, which is agrees with the string theory result for the rotating string, folded string. And I have this new stuff. So I have a simple G dependence and a series, and I hide everything I don't want in these CPs. So what is now the trick? That comes, I want to determine these CPs, but how should one do this? And this is a numerical input. You really take a strange limit on, I didn't show you what these coefficients are, on the coefficient of the series coefficients of these little gammas. And you study it in a very strange limit, and you will see that they have a very nice analytic behavior, which is very surprising. And from this behavior, in this limit, you can, essentially after many, many steps, you can determine these C plus coefficients to all orders, I would say, if you want a computer that is big enough.
So maybe you could also say how the CP behave for large P so people can see how badly divergent the series is.
Oh, I think I don't have them.
Anyway, you see some gamma of 2P, so it's definitely has zero radius of convergence.
I didn't show them because they are not very nice. Okay, and then you just determine from this study, you compute all the CP coefficients and put it in this expression, and you just work out what is this scaling function of these twist two operators. And I think there's no real bound. You can go on to any order in one over G. It just depends on your computational power. So I think Basil Pachensky and Kotasi, they did like G to the 1 over G to the 40. But I just gave some results. And this is an exact agreement with the string data that was first obtained the leading order by Dubsa, Klebov, and Polyakov, and the finite part full of Zeitlin and these two people, the first next to leading order. Which this is something very amazing, because this is something completely different, but it agrees, I mean, not just in words, but really in numbers. The numbers you produce are exactly the same. Of course, this is very challenging to say something about, I mean, 40 loops of string computations. Okay, so this was about the cusp anomalous dimension. I want to repeat everything again, but put it in a different name. I want to call the virtual scaling function. What do I mean with this? Okay, I said we have these twist operators, and they are represented by this derivative acting on the background field L. I call M the spin, and L the twist, and they have this. I know I go on, just you see, I just go on one step. Before I had this formula, how the leading asymptotic part behaves to the logarithm, and now I pull out the finite part, which of course I can always do by just looking at the explicit results. So I just go, I go one step further. What comes here is 1 over m, log m over m. I don't want that. I just want b of that. I want to say, okay, what is this object? And I call this, the name is a little bit inherited from the QCD splitting function, and I call this the virtual. Okay. So it's just the finite order correction to the leading spin asymptotics. So, and what you can do for finite values of the spin, you can always you can compute the anomalous dimension for especially twist two and three operators, and you can do this analytically in terms of harmonic sums or something like this, analytic corticals or other way, and you can do this from the Baxter equation. It's really not a nice thing, but you have to stop at some point because of wrapping effects. Maybe you can want to draw a little table. Do we need some light? Okay. So let's see. Okay, for example, if you go to twist 2, I put L equals 2, and wrapping effects enter at, I think, 8, G to the 8. So what do we have? I make a case. I have L, and I have the order of the coupling constant. So what can I compute from the beta? If I put L equals 2, I can compute G to the 2. I can compute 4, 6, and G to the 8. So this I can do. And here I have wrapping effects at G to the 8. So this is something I don't know what it does. So I better don't touch it. But I can go on to twist 3 operators and just do the same thing. I compute the anomalous dimension, and they're always given by some set of harmonic sums. I will show you later what these results look like. So, and you can, of course, you can just do the same. Of course, here you can go to G to the 8, more, 10. I just, of course, take twist 3. I can go here. So what I get is something like some stairs. I have the blue line, which always on the plane wing, you do not cross this line, because what you get is wrong. So I don't want to cross that line yet. Okay. So anything what I want to say, anything that you can compute from the beta under that depends on this twist L is wrong at a certain point, at a certain order in perturbation theory. So because this is of these varying contributions, and now let me just point here, make a few statements on these wrapping contributions. Pick a special operator, which I mean, like the simplest operators, the spin 2, twist 2 condition operator. I know many people work on this. What is the real answer for the anomalous dimension which we want? So the first thing I think is the first attempt was by taking the asymptotic dilatation generator and to look at all the diagrams which appear, take it at 6, at 1, 2, 3, 4 loop order. And then, I don't remember correctly, but they took something off, diagrams which didn't belong to the calculation, and put wrapping diagrams in. So they take something off and put something in, and then they compute the anomalous dimension. So then there was a second attempt by using the generalized Lucia formulas, which we also talked about, So this concept is a little bit different. You just take the beta Ansatz equation, which you think is wrong, and you add something to it. You add contributions from the solution. So you don't take anything off, which is very surprising, because they have to take something off. So you just add something, okay? And then you can also sit down and say, oh, don't care about this, I just computed the time that I have against these 131,015. And I work it out, and what's the good thing about it is they all agree. And this is in favor of one algorithm, which you say, oh, I picked that one. You go to general twist and you work out all five dynamics, maybe not. So you better take something that is a little bit more, which you can be performed on a computer, I mean also. So I think this is in favor of this Lucia formalism, if you want to go on. You want to compute analogous dimension, not just for spin 2, but for general spin, for every spin. And this was done by Fanyo, Yanni, and Lukowski. So they worked that out. So they had a little bit. They had to do an assumption that is how the result, what is the analytic structure of the result. They use this maximum transcendental principle, which just states whatever you add has a mathematical pattern. And you put this pattern, and then you can compute the unknown functions of that. This is the input. But they have a very strong check that what they do is correct, because they can take this whole expression, which depends on the spin, and analytically continue to the point m, I didn't put it, m minus 1. And then I get some poles of the harmonic sums. And this is completely in agreement with all pole prediction from the EFL equations. There's a very strong statement that what they are doing is correct. And there's also someone, Rafijani, who just computed again all the Feynman diagrams for the leading transcendental part. And it's of course the same. So I want to say that this result is very likely, let me say, it's correct. There's nothing against it so far.
Question. Yeah, the Byrne et al. Stuff that's not relevant to these computations? Do you have to really compute all these Feynman diagrams?
The for loop twist 2. Yeah, because Bernard Alley takes a large spin limit, and you want to take finite spin. I think you cannot reconstruct a finite spin answer, because their computations are done in the large spin limit.
Do you
know
what large spin limit means?
I don't know what large spin limit means for them.
But what does it mean for you? I don't know what large
spin limit means. Okay. What I mean is, I have a result, something. If I have finite spin, I have some result. Anomalous dimension is giving of some harmonic sums with some index. I mean, it's a nested sum which depends on the spin. And if I take the large n limit, I will get some divergent parts, which always come from S1. I think this is one of the only divergent harmonic sums. And I will get transcendental numbers out of that, like zetas and pi's and everything. So this is what I mean. If you take the large spin limit of this m result, if you would do this with this, you of course get the Bern et al. Result for the large spin limit. And this is all, you're right. So this is also a check. If they do this for loop computation, it, Bern et al. Only capture the leading log. No, I think you cannot use it. Okay. Because I want to, here it is already on the slide. Why you cannot use it? I mean, this is the result which they worked out. So you have something S1 squared, the argument is M. So this is a for loop anomalous dimension, just the wrapping piece. The other piece is very long. I don't want to show that, because this is the one we want to go for. This is the one you add to the beta Ansatz result. And if you just work out what is the behavior in large M, you see that this gamma wrapping behaves like log squared over M squared. And this is why you cannot use the Bern et al. Result, because they capture the leading poles, which goes like log M. So, but this is far beyond in the expansion somehow. And if I want now to compute, let me say, I want to compute this B, where I had it. I wrote like, I have some function. Okay, I take the limit where M goes to infinity. So I have some function f of g, which multiplies the log. And I have some function that doesn't depend on m. Yeah, I have a finite part. And this is very nice that this result goes like log squared m over m squared, because it tells me I can just go on. This g to the 8 result for b is correct, because it is not affected by the leading wrapping correction, which is the only one at for loops. So I can go on to this ladder. So that's very nice. So maybe what I want to convince you, let's try what happens in this box. Can we repeat this? And this is something
So the main point I really want to address is that how this wrapping part behaves in the large M limit. So now we just, and we worked, I worked out the twist tree at five loops with Matteo Beccaria, Valentina Fiorini, and Tomasz Lukowski again. So we computed the five-loop anomalous dimension from the beta ansatz, assuming maximal transcendentality, using reciprocity, Lüscher formalism. So everything we put had to put in everything because it's really the result is not very nice. Of course, it's long but nice. Okay, let me put it like this. And it agrees. Everything that comes from the wrapping agrees with what we heard about from the Y system. So this is also very good. But unfortunately, we just compute something. We don't know what we are computing because we don't know if it's correct. I mean, the beta ansatz gives it, and we add a wrapping part. We cannot really state if this is the correct answer. I mean, the analytic beta part will be, but the wrapping part, so there's no real check like for twist 2 because you don't. There's no BFKL equation which predicts you the poles at spin point minus 1 because your sums are of argument m half. They just don't have any poles. That's a little bit odd. So. But you can work out the pole structure at m minus 2, which is somehow the nearest pole to the origin. And it, strangely, if you do that, the formula of the pole structures can be resummed, and you get a very nice function. And it agrees with a conjecture which was just only made for the beta ansatz by Anatoly and Lev Lipatov, Adam and Matthias and Vitaly Velizhianin, which is very surprising because we take the beta ansatz and we add something, and both together give us a correct analytic structure. But I think your function was not meant to, I don't know. But okay, this is some indication which I tell, okay, that's nice. I believe that it is enough because I don't have more checks to do. So let me show you what the result looks like when I was talking about sums. I think I can click on this. So this is a, I put it to 10. This is a five loop anomalous dimension that comes from the beta ansatz. You see, what you have harmonic sums, you have nested harmonic sums, but they are always of the same transcendental degree, and they are of argument m half. This is why there are no poles at minus 1. But that's not all. There's more to come. There's another slide. It goes on. So there's many, many sums, and you know, you don't want to really use this result for anything. So you see, maybe just some comments. So you have zeta 3 terms and zeta 5, which come from the dressing phase, and this. The dressing phase is the only one in the analytic part which gives you these numbers, these transcendental numbers. And here's the wrapping part. This I want to address too. Because there's this function S1 squared, which is of argument M half. And if you know how the harmonic sum diverges for large M, it goes like log M, and then you can work out the finite part, which is gamma Euler. And if you have M half, it has also a log 2. So if you know how these sums behave, you can work out the large M limit of this expression. This is what you want, because I want to tell you about this box here. And the only thing that determines a large divergence is this S1 squared. This is somehow also inherited from the Lüscher formalism, because it gets always factored. Okay, oh, now I have to click. Oh, oops. Oh, this was too much. I have to push the button. Okay, I have to go on. Okay, so if you work it out, you see that the behavior of the five-loop anomalous dimension, the wrapping part, is again log m over m squared. That's very nice, because now I can come back to this table and I can fill in another thing. That means if I want to compute B of L, I can also do it to five-loop accuracy for twist 3. Okay, now I want to sell you something. Now comes the big thing I want you to believe. That is the one to all argument. I say, if I can the second, I claim I can go here. This means G to infinity, twist 2, B of L. This is a very rude assumption, this, which I just make based on ignorance. Just I believe it, and I want you to believe it. So the assumption is B of L to all loop orders in the Young-Bolz coupling has a form L times a universal function plus a universal function. This is my assumption. And this, okay, I call it the pig in the poke, but in Germany we call it the cat in the bag. So this is, the cat pops out here, please buy it. So I want to convince you that this works now. Okay, now let's just compute this thing. We think it's correct, just compute it to all orders. Don't worry about what we are computing. Okay, how do we do that? From the beta onwards, it's very tricky. It's not, I mean, I think it is possible, but there's some more, a better suited thing to do that. And this is from the nonlinear integral equation of the SL2 sector, which takes into account some hidden degrees of freedom of the beta ansatz, if I can call it like this. This takes into account holes of the transfer matrix. Like, let me explain it. For the one-loop beta equation, this is not the beta, the Baxter equation, I'm sorry. So let me call the off-shell version of the beta equation the Baxter equation, and if there's also an index L missing, I'm also sorry. So this is something. So how do I get the beta equation from that? If I claim, if this is a polynomial which is factorized in its roots, if I pick a root such that it belongs to the beta equations, there's, if I factor over all roots, there's, gives me one zero. So this is zero, and I get back the beta equations. But this is not the only possibility. I can also say that this transfer matrix has a zero. That gives me a zero. And this is what I will call whole. If I factorize a transfer matrix as a over its roots, and I pick one root of, if I say this U here is one root of the set of zeros, I get zero. I also get the beta equation. So there is something more which the beta equations don't know about, and this is taken into account by this nonlinear integral equation. But I don't want to present anything of this integral equation. I just want to state here we can use it, and this is a thing that is more suitable to use it. And you just take it and work out the integral equation to order. To the finite order of spin that is this, that determines this B of L. And this is the integral equation. So sigma is the density of beta roots, and you get again this kernel which we have. This is the only thing that appears is this kernel. So you got again some P's, which was, so the black stuff, like if I put it like it's not quite correct, the black stuff is the same we had before. But now we have more. We have more potential terms. Yeah. And these terms directly take into account these order of one corrections. And now I want to go on and solve this integral equation in at weak and then strong coupling. Okay? The point is, I wrote it in a little bit artificial way, you might complain, that I pulled already out a finite part, gamma Euler, and I also pulled out that part. But that really doesn't matter. I could all put it back in, because it is fine with my assumption that B is linear in L. Okay? So what I will do, the first thing is, I say that the part we had here that determines the cusp anomalous dimension, I just drop it. We already had it. I just go on for the new part. I separate the finite order corrections. So the anomalous dimension again of this, if you use this term for the density, is given by this expression, and it behaves like this because that's how I choose to write it. So you see, I'm a little bit cheating because I pull out the finite part and put it into F because I already know that it goes with F from the equation. I think this is something to do. I could also put it back in there, but I don't want it because computationally it's a little bit nicer to put it here. And I simply drop it. I scratch this out and I just go for the new potential terms. So I told you that's a strong coupling thing because this is not, it's an asymptotic series with zero weight of convergence. It's not a nice thing to do because it took a very long time and many people to work it out. So what you want to do is, I don't want to sit down and do all this again because maybe I also don't know. I just want to map. I want to map my integral equation to their result. I want to reuse the most thing. I want to reuse everything that is on the market so far and just put it back in. And I want to find a map that determines my solution in terms of all the other solutions. And this can be done. And again, you start with a trick. Now I will talk about a little bit how to solve this integral equation, maybe a little bit technically. So you decompose it again into parity, even and odd parts. And if you remember what the equations before looked like, they were almost the same. But here was a zero, and there here was just this delta N1. And the trick, I mean, now we get a really bloody inhomogeneity, which is not very nice. But that comes from the additional potential in the Fredholm equation. Okay, this I have to deal with somehow. And then I make a really stupid trick. I put a dummy index, which doesn't do anything. I put it in that way that if I put it to zero, I get the BES equation. And if I put it to one, I get my equation. Okay, this equation makes for me only sense if J is equal to one. But I just put it. So J is some index. It doesn't know any. The only use is that if you put it to zero, we get BES. If you put it to one, you get the new thing. But this is something that is really good, because now I want to work with these integral equations. I just choose one J slash anything. It can be anything. And I multiply both sides of the integral equation with some system that belongs on J slash. Yeah, I didn't tell you what this is, but it comes from the expansion of these little gamma functions. So that's something that has a sense in this language of the integral equation. So I do this, and I multiply with just some reference state, which I just pick randomly. Then I perform the sum over all n, and I can work out a few sums. Yeah, because I know how these usual functions, which are, oh, well, let me go back. So I put an index j here, yeah? So the function knows to which class it belongs. Yeah. So I know how the functions of class 0 behave. Yeah.
What's the difference between the j in the circumstance?
That this is artificially put, yeah, and they got a j by the expansion. And the difference is also that it here it works perfectly, and they, for them it's more complicated. This is easier. I mean, you can really, with this j, you can map it completely to the solution. They have to work out a little bit more, I think. For them it's more complicated. Yeah, but I also called it J. I think it's misleading if you know about this generalized scaling function. But it's artificially put to do the same.
But
to
you
put
do again a sort of scalar product.
Yeah. I mean, I essentially this is the same trick, but only that I have to put it by hand. It doesn't pop up on its own. Okay. So I do that, and I work with all these integrals, and I put them in such a way, I put it here, you have two new, even an odd coupled integral equation, infinite set, which now depend on this J slash, which I don't know anything about, so and I subtract something of the other one, and I do that until I reach a point where I got an integral that is invariant under, oh, there should be a minus, No, that's invariant under changing j and j slash. Okay, this is something I can work out. I see that the integral is not sensible to this change. It just has the same. But the equation will pop up in such a way that there's some this integral is equal something, and the equal something is not invariant under this. So I impose the condition on the result of the integral, which I for sure don't know, but I just impose the condition that this is the same. And this gives me an integral equation for b of l. This is what we want, okay? So I put here this index j we had before to 1. So I do, this is b of l, and you get it in that way. And this is already suited for the strong coupling expansion, which I want to perform now. But I just want to show you that you can check it, that all you did is correct. If you plug in the BES solution, so this little 0 here, which pops up everywhere, that indicates this is a known solution you already had. I know these functions from the computation I performed above. Okay, and if I put them all in, I find the correct result from my original integral equation. I could do that. And it also agrees with the maximum transcendental part of the QCD splitting function. I mean, also the virtual part, if I just compare. So it looks good. Okay, strong coupling. Okay, the strong coupling works a little bit in the same lines. I make this change of variables, I perform, and then I get some integrals again. I perform all these integrals, as many as I can do. And what I can write in the end, already it's strong coupling, so I skip all that part, how that works, is I write b of l at g infinity, somehow it's given by this expression. It's 16g squared, and this function gamma 1, and down here you have the function, what is gamma 1. So there enters a few objects. First, is gamma 1, I'm sorry, this is the scaling, this multiplies 16g is the scaling function. This is known, this I don't need. This is a little bit odd that this pops up here. This is the first generalized scaling function, and I don't want to comment how it comes out. But this has also been analyzed separately, so that's known. And I get some new sums, but these sums are sums over these gamma coefficients, and I should have put an index 0. These are exactly the coefficients that determine also the cusp anomalous dimension. But it's a little bit different because I have to perform infinite sums over the coefficients which depend on G. But you can do this. You just take your old coefficients and put them in this equation and sum it, and then you get a result for B2, for example, which is sensible to string theory result. You get this, just to show you what it looks like. It's something nice. You get something that is multiplying f of g, then you see I get my little trick I did by pulling off gamma Euler, I get it back here. Maybe this was not... Okay. And I got some more, I get logs and everything, and 1 over g. So this is just up to the first few orders, but this is not really bound. I can go on to any order. The only problem is at this time I not only just need the coefficients, I need to perform infinite sums over them, which is a little bit more tricky. Okay. Okay, so this little object E of 1, is just an unknown, but this is completely identified with the first generalized scaling function, which was also studied by Basso Kochemski and Fioravanti, Grinzer, and Rossi. And it's very nice, it's just minus 1, so I don't need to worry about that. But it has non-perturbative effects if G goes to infinity. But I don't want to comment on this. Everything has non-perturbative effects. And what I will get here in the end is, again, an asymptotic series. That makes it so hard. So, and here, again, are some functions that I go into here. But okay. But I just want to point out that these gammas are given here, and they depend on the CP. But I know them. Okay.
Do you know what these non-perturbative effects on the warship theory? What would that be? So, is there any...
Hold on. Because what I computed, you can say, is nothing, because I made a very rude assumption. It could be anything I'm computing, but this is a check in the end that it agrees exactly with string theory. Okay, this, and now I can use it. I know what f of g is. It pops up in the integral equation before. I know what our choice of the coupling constant. So I just put everything in, and I compute, I predict the string energy up to one loop. Okay, for this finite spin part of the string. Yeah, and this is this expression. And this is exactly in agreement with the string computation of Beccaria, Furini, Tertio, and Zeitlin. But they have, I'm not really into the formalism they use, but they have some constant which they cannot determine, unfortunately. So there is still some thing we can determine, and we determine this constant to be 6 log 2 plus pi. But there's an unpublished result by Nikolai Gromov, which I think he's using the algebraic curve approach. No? So, but he can also determine this function, and it's very good that it's exactly the same. So. I'm free to say I will try to say that I have proven this, that this was okay, because to get to strong coupling I had to resum all orders at weak coupling. To get there I had to resum everything up to G to infinity to say something about the strong coupling, and it matches exactly the string theory numbers. So okay, what, let me see what's on the next slide. What I said, we don't have to stop there. We can go on. We can go to any, I mean, it's a little bit more tricky than for the cusp, but we can predict many, many more results on the string theory side. And I don't know what, there's something to compute it, some mechanism. And we can also do more spin. We are not restricted to this, I don't have it, to the finite part. We can, we can go on to log squared over m squared. So I can compute everything up to the wrapping part. And the next term that comes here is log squared m over m squared. So this will be incorrect. That doesn't agree with string theory. But all that, up to that order, just for twist 2, I can just do it for twist 2, because that is restricted. You need the complete, I talked about these holes, and to do that, you need the complete solution to the hole dynamics. Unless, otherwise you cannot say anything. So that's only valid for twist 2. So this works, and this is in agreement with the string theory, because they also worked that out. It also matches perfectly. But it's not very surprising, because everything that pops up here is given by the functions I already determined, so this is in some sense trivial. But because it's inherited by reciprocity. The reciprocity constraints on the anomalous dimension tell you what these coefficients are. So that's not surprising. And they hold it, so we also showed that they hold at weak and strong coupling. But this is something you expect.
So is the reciprocity in this case proven or assumed?
No. If I have, we computed this expansion, and you could say this proves reciprocity. Because reciprocity tells you about the expansion, but only to the V-loop. So I don't know what this means, where it comes from, but we get this form, which is in favor of this. Okay, and it also, okay, agrees with string theory. I started with gluon amplitudes. So I didn't mention that in the last minutes. I said that the leading poles are identical, but the subleading singularities, they are different. And what they differ is exactly this B2 of G. And I took this from some paper of Dixon, Magnier, and Stermann. I mean, this G is some of the collinear anomalous dimension of the gluon amplitude. This is a Wilson loop, and they differ by this function B. And this is consistent with all data. I mean, this is pretty much the data is restricted to the two-loop calculations of the Wilson loop for 4 and 5 legs. So this matches everything. And it also matches, if you look at the QCD papers, by Moch, and you just take the, you shop everything off, that is not of maximal transcendentality, it matches exactly all this too. But I think Moch told me that it is not surprising because it is how we constructed it, but I didn't know. Okay, And then the last point, the last statement, so this is somehow, I got this function for the collinear anomalous dimension, one half of the function of the gluon amplitudes, so I put one half times one quarter is 3/8, I hope. So we could say gluon amplitudes are now 3/8 solved. Okay. Okay. So what did I tell you about? I told you about how to determine these finite order corrections of the large spin asymptotics through the twist operators at weak and at strong coupling. So, and because I made a very rude assumption which was not really justified, we have to justify it somehow. And this is by taking the result to strong coupling by resumming all orders of the weak coupling expansion, and it matches with string theory. And we can produce not only the finite correction for twist 2, all these others, as I said, but they depend on the functions that you already know, but with this is okay with reciprocity. So we obtained a further interpolating function which you can take all the way from weak coupling to strong coupling, and it agrees with string theory calculations. And this also somehow implies a reassurance of the dressing phase which were popping up in the equation, because that really contributes a lot to this. Okay. And so this determines the difference between subplichting poles of gluon amplitudes and Wilson loops, and I said it's 3/3 solved. Okay. Okay. What could one continue to do? What is could be done? So how would you compute 1/g corrections in string theory? I don't know. I just write it to this slide. But you could also compute subleading spin corrections for spiky string configurations, not just the folded string, but I think more spikes. This should correspond to our B, where you put L as the number of spikes. So L equals 3 at this. I don't know. I think there are no computations for the finite spin contribution to this. Okay. And what is for the gluon amplitudes, what you could do, we still have something that is open, G iconal. Can you make sense of this anyhow in N equals 4? Can you say something about it? Okay. Can you go on, such as say, can you go on from 3/8 to solve the amplitudes to 1/2. Okay, thanks.
I'm sure you said many times, but are these just planar contributions to gluon amplitudes?
What?
Are these just planar contributions to gluon amplitudes, or are you claiming that you have the full gluon amplitude?
No, no, it's just a minor contribution to the divergent part. It's 1/2 of the 1/ε pole.
So these are planar.
Planar.
Just planar.
Just planar. Sorry, I didn't get that.
And does S-duality tell you anything about this kind of stuff?
Oh, I don't know what the S-duality.
No, because
of away from planar. Yeah, S-duality, right, as Ethea said, doesn't keep you within the planar physics, because G to 1/g. And so g squared n goes to n squared over g squared n, so you have the extra n squared in. Is that, yeah. Which is too bad, I mean, right, so it means that there's
something. Yeah, but somehow this actually has something to do with integrability in some kind of way. Like I said in the beginning, I mean, somehow you kill it to get integrability, but then if you kill integrability, you gain that, so I mean, some sign of hope for the future.
It smells like the things that Pierre was doing with Michael. And, I mean, they see all these transcendental functions and they see all these modules.
Yeah. The point is, I mean, you're asking about the maximum transcendental principle. If you're
things like that.
Okay, so the point is that in gravity, if you start splitting planar and non-planar diagram, then you don't see anything. But then when you sum them, there seems to be some sort of transcendental principle. So at one loop, you can somewhat understand it by what you get from the trees, and you know, re-injecting with unitarity. And at two loops, at some point, it should work. But it's not clear why. I mean, it's the case. I mean, so. For example, why is, for example, when you say the for loop on some match, why there's no, it has to be, no. Which one? I mean, for loop is weight 6, I mean, that's fine. But I mean, when you get.
So for loop is 8, yeah.
And for loop is weight 8, right? So, but you don't see multi zeta function. So you have only single zeta functions.
Okay.
So the question is that where they could be? They could be in the non-planar sector.
Mm-hmm. You mean multivariate zeta functions?
So I think, so if you understand how linearity works, to understand how this maximal transformative principle can work and separate the planar and the non-planar and make this mess into, I don't know. I mean, it's difficult to state, to make a precise statement, but I mean, clearly, gravity, I mean, for combine the planar and non-planar sector to work, if you want.
So if one wanted to be mean, one could sort of do the counting a little differently. There used to be three unknown functions, and now you've found half of a function, but there's another unknown function, so it's further away.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's a little bit... So I don't know, I must admit, I don't know the physical reason for this split of the collinear part, which I think there was some question to be risen about the scheme dependence, because essentially I can shift it by just changing the infrared cutoff. I can put any crap I want into the 1 over epsilon poles. So I cannot answer this question really, but I think maybe the difference is the only physical quantity that makes sense somehow. If you use both in both calculations, in the gluons and the Wilson loops, the same scheme.
Yeah. It's also a bit funny counting, right? Because there are a couple of functions which depend on the coupling constant, and then finally there's the finite function which depends on anything. So we maybe have one or two functions of the coupling constant which we know, and then one function which depends on the number of legs and all the momentum. Mm-hmm. Which would be desirable to solve. Just an, I mean, okay, maybe you're 3/8 done, but there's an infinite amount of work to
do. Yeah.
There are some finite restrictions on this function, probably from a dual conformal symmetry world identities, right?
Yeah. Oh, but this captures the finite part.
I was talking about the finite part, yeah. Which I wouldn't call it just.
Okay.
Okay. So I missed the point made. So can you explain again why this Bochor scaling function yours is really the QCD splitting function?
Because it's, the twist 2 anomalous dimension which you compute in QCD, I think which are related to the evolution kernel by a Mellin transform. If you just chop off all the thing you don't want and take the maximum transform of the part, we are computing just the same thing, just with somehow more symmetry. We only see the nice sums that pop up in the QCD result. So if you just compare this, it gives you exactly the same answer.
What is G? I could understand.
Yeah, I don't know. This would be the question. Yeah, I don't know what G iconal is. I mean, this is a placeholder, something. This is everything I don't know, I put in there. Come on. Yeah, I think, but it is related. I think it is related. No, I'm saying something which I really don't understand. It is related to the anomalous dimension of some dwell yarn processes which correspond to some Wilson loop configurations. I think was one by Belitsky in the end of the 90s, and if you also shop off again with a nice part which you like, a symmetric part, it agrees to this somehow perturbatively to this quantity G iconal. But I don't know, I have no clue what is the operator interpretation. Okay, there is a little clue which I don't want to say because I don't know if it's wrong. Because there is hope. There is maybe hope that you can get somehow some sensible thing out of this.
And a more technical question. When you use the integral equations, which part of the Dressing kernel do you really probe?
What
part of the Dressing kernel do you probe when you check string results or?
I take everything. Results? I need everything.
Yeah, you take everything, but then you make expansion. It becomes.
I don't make. I make an expansion, but to get something at strong coupling, I need to resum all orders at weak coupling. So I take.
The full S matrix, all orders of the S matrix.
I mean, in the large spin limit, I just work in the large spin limit. So to say anything about this is a whole argument. I mean, why this is correct. Because what I'm doing to say anything about string theory, I I resum everything of the gauge theory, and that means I resum everything that comes from the dressing phase.
You have a dressing factor which has a weak coupling expansion and a strong coupling.
No, but that's the point. Yeah, he's not first expanding sort of beta under the dressing phase and then doing the complement as many people have done, but he's really using the beta under to write some solution in a finite radius around g equals zero. And then he is really working with that solution and extrapolating it. So somehow you first solve the beta equation and then you expand, as opposed to first approximating the beta equation and then solving them.
There was a feature noticed by Maldacena and Swanson that, in fact, you have to use, in some regions, you have to use the S matrix is the sum resummation of all orbits of 1 over G. You don't use, for example, just AFS and DHL.
Yeah, that's what I want to.
Yeah, No, you have to use exactly any of these singularities.
Because, for example,
you
I know that.
You have to do a resummation of all your orders in 1 over G of the scattering phase in order to get the one over leading of 1/g.
Stefan said this, but let's stress it one more time. How it's really sort of the Toft's old dream come true. I mean, you basically solve. I mean, you can show that what you are doing at weak coupling is just this incredibly complicated sum of hundreds of thousands of Feynman diagrams, and to next order millions, and then tens of millions. You can show that. So basically, you're really summing up planar diagrams, and then showing that they converge because you're at large n, and then you take this expansion and analytically continue it to strong coupling. I mean, just exactly.
But if you replace the kernel with
some other. For some reason, doesn't care about our stuff, but we really
So if you pick the dressing phase and keep the same strong coupling and weak coupling expansion of the dressing phase, but replace the dressing phase by something which in the middle is a bit different, this would not work.
No, it would be.
No, in fact, the expansion of the dressing phase is not uniform, so you cannot say that you can expand it. If you take AFS, Hernandez, Lopez, and the next, uh-huh. This is not enough as a leading expansion in one.
But for example, from the algebraic curve, which Stefan mentioned, it certainly is enough to use only AFS.
Oh. Yeah, but it's here now.
Can I ask something about non-perturbative stuff which
okay.
you have? Mm. Just in parentheses, I know that the structure of result reminds me very much some old stuff about C equals 1 matrix model, and mm-hmm. it was noticed in the early papers in the S50 algebra. In particular, this exponential corrections e to the minus pi g, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. curiously, even the normalization is the same. You meet them in some exact double scaling results in the C equals 1 matrix model. And there we know the interpretation for them. We know that there are certain instantons, mm-hmm. eigenvalues on the top of some potential. Here, do you have some idea of physical interpretation of these terms?
I think everything that pops up here. Okay, first relating to Pedro, if you resum everything at recoupling, you get string theory. Yeah, if you resum everything at strong coupling, you don't get gauge theory because you have these non-perturbative effects. And they are somehow driven by the mass gap parameter of the O6 model. And it also pops up here. I don't know why. This I cannot answer. But you have some.
It should be rather some explanation on the string side. It's big G.
But there in the exponential.
Are there some instantons or whatever.
I don't know.
String theory related to this non-perturbative correction.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know. The string calculations done by Zeitlin, I think they don't see these non-perturbative corrections. I don't. That this computation by Maldacena and who computed this O6 sigma model, they see that somehow they have to put in these effects which are related to the mass gap of the O6 model, and it pops up here everywhere. I mean everything has problems with non-perturbative effects which you don't see, because the point is why you don't see it is an analytic condition on these big gammas which I used. You can, I mean, there was this by Kochemsky very recently, this new analysis, if you pay a little bit more attention, you can even work out the non-perturbative effects from the gauge theory side. But I didn't read it yet, so, but there's some argument. But I don't know what there's a physical reason for this. Why does it pop up here? This I don't know. But it comes out everywhere, yeah.
Yeah, but in the matrix model, this is not the worship instance, right? This is
something different.
Some different with the eigenvalues, yeah. So, yeah.
In some sense, yeah. You know, you see them also on the worksheet.
Yeah. But this looks, So on the worksheet, it's funny. You would expect some worship instance somehow to have this behavior, right? But there's no worship instance.
You have sort of deep brains.
Yeah.
Bullshit interpretation.
Those instances
there.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you.